Jody chose the hotel for the night. She did it by finding the travel section in the nearest bookstore to the NBRC building. She stood there and leafed through the local guides until she found a place recommended in three of them. "It's funny, isn't it?" she said. "We're in St. Louis here, and the travel section has more guides to St. Louis than any place else. So how is that a travel section? Should be called the stay-at-home section." Beecher was a little nervous. This method was new to him. The sort of places he normally patronized never advertised in books. They relied on neon signs on tall poles, boasting attractions that had stopped being attractions and had become basic human rights about 20 years ago, like air and cable and a pool. "Hold this," she said. He took the book from her and kept his thumb on the page while she squatted down and opened her carry-on. She rooted around and found her mobile phone, took the book back from him, and stood right there in the aisle and called the hotel. Reacher watched Jody. He had never called a hotel. The places he stayed always had a room no matter when. They were delirious if their occupancy rates ever made it above 50%. He listened to Jody's end of the conversation and heard her mentioning sums of money that would have bought him a bed for a month, given a little haggling. "Okay," she said. "We're in. It's their honeymoon suite. Four-poster bed. Is that neat or what?" He smiled. "The honeymoon suite." "We need to eat," he said. "They serve dinner there?" She shook her head and thumbed through the book to the restaurant section. "More fun to go someplace else for dinner," she said. "You like French?" He nodded. "My mother was French." She checked the book and used the mobile again and reserved a table for two at a fancy place in the historic section near the hotel. 8 o'clock, she said. "Gives us time to look around a little. Then we can check in at the hotel and get freshened up." "Call the airport," he said. "We need early flights out. Dallas-Fort Worth should do it." "I'll do that outside," she said. "Can't call the airport from a bookstore." He carried her bag and she bought a gaudy tourist map of St. Louis, and they stepped out into the heat of the late afternoon sun. He looked at the map and she called the airline from the sidewalk and reserved two business-class seats to Texas, 8:30 in the morning. Then they set out to walk the banks of the Mississippi where it ran through the city. They strolled arm in arm for 90 minutes, which took them about 4 miles, all the way around to the historic part of town. The hotel was a medium-sized old mansion set on a wide, quiet street lined with chestnut trees. It had a big door painted shiny black and oak floors the color of honey. Reception was an antique mahogany desk standing alone in the corner of the hallway. Reacher stared at it. The places he normally stayed, reception was behind a wire grill or boxed in with bulletproof plexiglass. An elegant lady with white hair ran Jody's card through the swipe machine and the charge slip came chattering out. Jody bent to sign it and the lady handed Reacher a brass key. "Enjoy your stay, Mr. Jacob," she said. The honeymoon suite was the whole of the attic. It had the same honey oak floor, thickly varnished to a high shine with antique rugs scattered across it. The ceiling was a complicated geometric arrangement of slopes and dormer windows. There was a sitting room at one end with two sofas in pale floral patterns. The bathroom was next and then the bedroom area. The bed was a gigantic four-poster, swathed in the same floral fabric and high off the ground. Jody jumped up and sat there, her hands under her knees, her legs swinging in space. She was smiling and the sun was in the window behind her. Reacher put her bag down on the floor and stood absolutely still, just looking at her. Her shirt was blue, somewhere between the blue of a cornflower and the blue of her eyes. It was made from soft material, maybe silk. The buttons looked like small pearls. The first two were undone. The weight of the collar was pulling the shirt open. Her skin showed through at the neck, paler honey than the oak floor. The shirt was small, but it was still loose around her body. It was tucked deep into her belt. The belt was black leather, cinched tight around her tiny waist. The free end was long, hanging down outside the loops on her jeans. The jeans were old, washed many times, and immaculately pressed. She wore her shoes on bare feet. They were small blue penny loafers, fine leather, low heels, probably Italian. He could see the soles as she swung her legs. The shoes were new, barely worn at all. "What are you looking at?" she asked. She held her head at an angle, shy and mischievous. "You," he said. The buttons were pearls, exactly like the pearls from a necklace taken off the string and sewn individually onto the shirt. They were small and slippery under his clumsy fingers. There were five of them. He fiddled four of them out through their buttonholes and gently tugged the shirt out of the waistband of her jeans and undid the fifth. She held up her hands, left and right in turn, so he could undo the cuffs. He eased the shirt backward off her shoulders. She was wearing nothing underneath it. She leaned forward and started on his buttons. She started from the bottom. She was dexterous. Her hands were small and neat and quick, quicker than his had been. His cuffs were already open. His wrists were too wide for any store-bought cuff to close over them. She smoothed her hands up over the slab of his chest and pushed the shirt away with her forearms. It fell off his shoulders, and she tugged it down over his arms. It fell to the floor with the sigh of cotton and the lazy click of buttons on wood. She traced her finger across the teardrop-shaped burn on his chest. "You bring the salve?" "No," he said. She locked her arms around his waist and bent her head down and kissed the wound. He felt her mouth on it, firm and cool against the tender skin. Then they made love for the fifth time in 15 years, in the four-poster bed at the top of the old mansion, while the sun in the window fell away west towards Kansas. The NYPD's domestic violence unit borrowed squad room space wherever it could find it, which was currently in a large upstairs room above the administrative offices at One Police Plaza. O'Hallinan and Sark got back there an hour before the end of their shift. That was the paperwork hour, and they went straight to their desks and opened their notebooks to the start of the day and began typing. They reached their visit to the St. Vincent's ER with 15 minutes to go. They wrote it up as a probable incident with a non-cooperative victim. O'Hallinan spooled the form out of her typewriter and noticed the Tahoe's plate number scrawled at the bottom of her notebook page. She picked up the phone and called it in to the Department of Motor Vehicles. "Black Chevrolet Tahoe," the clerk told her, "registered to Cayman Corporate Trust with an address in the World Trade Center." O'Hallinan shrugged to herself and wrote it all down in her notebook. She was debating whether to put the form back at the typewriter and add the information to it, when the DMV clerk came back on the line. "I've got another tag here," he said. "Same registered owner abandoned a black Chevrolet Suburban on Lower Broadway yesterday. 3-vehicle moving traffic incident. 15th Precinct towed the wreck." "Who's dealing with it? You got a name at 15th? "Sorry, nope." O'Hallinan hung up and called traffic in the 15th Precinct, but it was shift change at the end of the day, and she got no farther with it. She scrawled a reminder to herself and dropped it in her in-tray. Then the clock ticked around to the top of the hour, and Sark stood up opposite her. "And we're out of here," he said. "All work and no play makes us dull people, right?" "Right," she said. "You want to get a beer?" "At least a beer," Sark said. "Maybe 2 beers. "Steady," she said. They took a long shower together in the honeymoon suite's spacious bathroom, then Reacher sprawled in his towel on a sofa and watched her get ready. She went into her bag and came out with a dress. It was the same line as the yellow linen shift she'd worn to the office, but it was midnight blue and silk. She slipped it over her head and wriggled it down into place. It had a simple scoop neck and came just above the knee. She wore it with the same blue loafers. She patted her hair dry with a towel and combed it back. Then she went into the bag again and came out with the necklace he'd bought her in Manila.
"Help me with this?"
She lifted her hair away from her neck and he bent to fasten the clasp. The necklace was a heavy gold rope, probably not real gold, not at the price he'd paid, although anything was possible in the Philippines. His fingers were wide and his nails were scuffed and broken from the physical labor with the shovel. He held his breath and needed 2 attempts to close the catch. Then he kissed her neck, and she let her hair fall back into place. It was heavy and damp and smelled like summer.
"Well, I'm ready at least," she said.
She grinned and tossed him his clothes from the floor, and he put them on, with the cotton dragging against his damp skin. He borrowed her comb and ran it through his hair. In the mirror, he got a glimpse of her behind him. She looked like a princess about to go out to dinner with her gardener. "They might not let me in," he said. She stretched up and smoothed the back of his collar down over the new exaggerated bulk of his deltoid muscle.
"How would they keep you out? Call the National Guard?"
It was a 4-block walk to the restaurant, a June evening in Missouri, near the river. The air was soft and damp. The stars were out above them in an inky sky the color of her dress. The chestnut trees rustled in a slight warm breeze. The streets got busier. There were the same trees, but cars were moving and parking under them. Some of the buildings were still hotels, but some of them were smaller and lower, with painted signs showing restaurant names in French. The signs were lit with aimed spotlights, no neon anywhere. The place she'd picked was called La Préfecture. He smiled and wondered if lovers in a minor city in France were eating in a place called the Municipal Offices, which was the literal translation as far as he recalled. But it was a pleasant enough place. A boy from somewhere in the Midwest trying a French accent greeted them warmly and showed them to a table in a candlelit porch overlooking the rear garden. There was a fountain with underwater lighting playing softly, and the trees were lit with spot lamps fastened to their trunks. The tablecloth was linen, and the silverware was silver. Meacher ordered American beer, and Jody ordered Pernod and water.
"This is nice, isn't it?" she said.
He nodded. The night was warm and still and calm. "Tell me how you feel," he said.
She looked at him surprised. "I feel good."
"Good how?" She smiled shyly. "Reacher, you're fishing." He smiled back. "No, I'm just thinking about something." "You feel relaxed?" She nodded. "Safe?" She nodded again. "Me too," he said. "Safe and relaxed. So what does that mean?" The boy arrived with the drinks on a silver tray. The Pernod was in a tall glass, and he served it with an authentic French water jug. The beer was in a frosted mug. No long-neck bottles in a place like this.
"So what does it mean?" Jody asked.
She splashed water into the amber liquid, and it turned milky. She swirled the glass to mix it. He caught the strong aniseed smell. "It means whatever is happening is small," he said. "A small operation based in New York. We felt nervous there, but we feel safe here." He took a long sip of the beer. "That's just a feeling," she said. "Doesn't prove anything." He nodded. "No, but feelings are persuasive, and there's some hard evidence. We were chased and attacked there, but nobody out here is paying any attention to us."
"You've been checking?" she asked, alarmed.
"I'm always checking," he said. "We've been walking around, slow and obvious. Nobody's been after us."
"No manpower."
He nodded again. "They had the 2 guys who went to the Keys and up to Garrison, and a guy driving the Suburban. My guess is that's all they've got, or they'd be out here looking for us. So it's a small unit based in New York." She nodded.
"I think it's Victor Hobie," she said.
The waiter was back with a pad and a pencil. Jody ordered pâté and lamb, and Reacher ordered soup and pork au pruneau, which had always been his Sunday lunch as a kid, any time his mother could find pork and prunes in the distant places they were stationed. It was a regional dish from the Loire, and although his mother was from Paris, she liked to make it for her sons because she felt it was a kind of shorthand introduction to her native culture. "I don't think it's Victor Hobie," he said.
"I think it is," he said.
"I think he survived the war somehow, and I think he's been hiding out somewhere ever since, and I think he doesn't want to be found." He shook his head. I thought about that too, right from the start. But the psychology is all wrong. You read his record, his letters. I told you what his old buddy, Ed Stevens, said. This was a straight-arrow kid, Jody. Totally dull, totally normal. I can't believe he'd leave his folks hanging like that. For 30 years? Why would he? It just doesn't jive with what we know about him. Maybe he changed, Jody said. Dad always used to say Vietnam changed people, usually for the worse. Reacher shook his head. He died, he said. 4 miles west of An K, 30 years ago. He's in New York, Jody said. Right now. Trying to stay hidden.